Recording.
What happened? I'm in the beginning of the second line in the Aramaic, middle of the second line in the English. They defile all the oils in the temple. Now, what normally happened when nations came in and they came into the temple? What did the non-Jewish world usually come into the temple? What did Babylonia come into the temple to do? When Babylonia came into the temple, what did they come to do?
Destroy it.
When the Romans came into the temple, what did they come to do?
Destroy it.
What are the Greeks coming to do? Gotcha. They touched the oil. That's all. Timu kol hashmanim. All they did is they touched it. That's a very strange kind of an exit, a very strange kind of an attack. Okay, timu kol hashmanim. Okay, and then it describes kishagara malchus yavam. That one flask of oil, right, which was pure, enough only to light for one day, 8 days. Okay, big holiday, huge miracle, oil for one day, burned for 8 days. There's one problem with making a big deal out of that miracle, and that's source number two. Source number two, even though according to most opinions, that was only the first temple, but the temple was a place of miracles. And we have the Mishnah Pirkei Avos, Asara Nisim, Nasul Avosenu, and it goes through 10 miracles that happen on a daily basis. So miracles was no big deal in the temple. So what's the big deal about this miracle of oil that we have to make a huge holiday over? So that's, and we're going to have to understand what's so special about this miracle that justified a holiday when miracles were commonplace and nobody made a big deal about them. Source 3, which is built on the continuation of the Gemara, but I wanted to see it in the Halakha, because we're all used to Chumras, and we're all used to Hechsherim that are Mahadrim, right? You know there's something called Kosher, right? And then there's something called Mahadrim, right? Mahadrim Hechsher, everybody's seen that around? Yes? Okay, so here, we're going to see the one place where we're actually introduced to it in a formal way. Says the Rambam, Kama neros hu madlik b'chanukah. How many candles is a person supposed to light on Chanukah? Source sheets are around. Kama neros hu madlik b'chanukah. How many lamp candles does a person light? So everybody knows they bought the Chanukah candles. There's 44 Chanukah candles because you need a shamus for each night, which is 8. And then the first night you light. And the second night you light. Right? And that's the only Chanukah you know, right? But guess what? That's not really the basic mitzvah of Chanukah. Okay, says the Rambam, based on the Gemara, Kama neros hu madlik b'chanukah, mitzvasa, the basic mitzvah of Chanukah candles is, sheyekol bayit ubayis madlik ner echad. One candle each night. So you don't need 44 candles. All you need is, if you need a shamas each night, you need 16 candles. One for each night. It doesn't matter how many members of the family there are, the entire household lights one candle every night. Okay, that's the basic mitzvah. Okay, the language in the Gemara is actually a more familiar word to you, but at least you could see that this is the root of the word you're familiar with. You're familiar with the word mahadrin, and you hope you see the root of that word mahadrin in this word. Mehader, a person who wants to embellish, a person who wants to upgrade the mitzvah. Madlik neros kiminyan anshei habayis. Ner l'kol echad ve'echad bein anoshim bein noshim. You want to do an upgrade of the mitzvah, so then you light one candle per night for each member of the household. So let's say there's a husband and there's a wife and there's four kids, so you light six candles every night. Okay, so that can actually end up needing a lot more than 44 candles. Okay? But you'll notice that we're at the upgraded level. Hamahad, are there source sheets up here, please, gentlemen? You want to come and pick up source sheets? All right, we're on source number 3. Yeah, take them, maybe pull them into the back. Have a seat on the chair. You don't need to sit in the back. Please. Okay, source number 3. We're at source number 3. Okay, here's... plenty of sheets. Right here, he's got it. He's got it. Okay? So, this is already a little bit of a strange thing that we have here legislated two levels of performance of the mitzvah. Right, we're not talking here about, okay, here's the mitzvah, but I want to be machmir. Okay? A chumrah and a mahadrin, we'll talk about what the difference is in a minute, but here we're talking about some kind of legislated, upgraded performance. And then the Rambam continues based on the Gemara. The Hamahader Yeser al Zeh. The language of the Gemara is also something you're used to if you were by really from Hechsherim. Mahadrin min Hamahader. That's the language of the Gemara. The Hamahader Yeser al Zeh. Osa mitzvah min Amuchar. You want to do the choicest mitzvah. Madlik ner lekol echad ve'echad. B'layla harishon u'mosi v'olich b'chol layla. Every person lights one, then two, then three, through eight, which is the way we do it. But what I want to focus on here is the unusual, and in fact it's the unique, only place in all of halacha where we have legislated into the basic mitzvah performance, three levels of performance. Basically, you have a halacha, and then you have a machlokas, different opinions, and so some people want to cover all the opinions, and some people say, well, this is an opinion I can rely on. But basically, it's a binary system. Either it is or it isn't. Okay? Here, you've got a graded, legislated way of performing the mitzvah. That's a very strange thing. It's the only place we find it. We have to understand why we should find it specifically here in Chanukah. And then in source number 4, all right, a little bit later in the Rambam has a language that is unique to him. It doesn't come from the Gemara, but it's the Rambam's, we'll call it editorial opinion, so to speak. You'll see in a minute. Mitzvah ner Chanukah, mitzvah chaviva hi ad me'ot. It's a very beloved mitzvah. Does that bother you? Does that language bother you? Why? All the mitzvahs are beautiful. What are we playing favorites? Right? You gotta immediately think about the question that every parent who has more than one child dreads. And every one of you, if you grew up in a house with siblings, certainly asked. What's that dreaded question?
Who's the favorite?
Who do you love best? Who do you love best? Right? Parents got that question from your kids? As kids, you ask your parents, and what's the answer? What's the answer?
All
we love you all the same! Sure! Yeah! Give me a break! You bought that? Come on! Give me a break! Okay? So, but we'll have to understand what the real answer is and why that might even be an appropriate answer. But what is this mitzvah? Chaviv? Chanukah candles is a beloved mitzvah more than any other mitzvah. What's going on? Okay, and therefore, Sarichanim li Zarbakarin lo dianes, ulahosi b'shevach, you have to be very meticulous and very careful to publicize the nace. And unusual, if a person has no money, and it comes Sukkot and he can't afford an esrog, does he have to go knocking door to door to schnorr money to buy an esrog? The answer is no. I don't know what happens today, and people, in fact, people might do it, it's a different issue. The halacha says if you don't have money, you don't. I don't have money, I can't afford an esrog. I can't buy an esrog, I can't buy an esrog. You don't have to schnorr money in order to fulfill a mitzvah. There's one mitzvah, there are a couple of mitzvahs that are exceptions. This is one of them. Afilu ein lo ma yochal ela min ha-tzedakah. He's supported by tzedakah. Shoel u-mocher ksu, so you got to sell the shirt off your back to buy money for Chanukah, for oil and Chanukah candles. Very unique. There's virtually no other mitzvah like this that you have to sell the shirt off your back and or you have to go snoring money in order to fulfill it. And again, we have to know why. There's one more Rambam, which I didn't bring. The Rambam concludes Hilchos Chanukah. I'll just read you the language. And again, it's very strange language in general, but it's even stranger that he specifically sticks it in at the end of Chanukah. All right, and we have the halacha here based on what we just saw now in Yud Beis, that if a person only has enough money to buy wine for Kiddush or oil for Chanukah candles, anybody know what takes precedence? Candles for Chanukah takes precedence over wine for Kiddush. But then the Rambam follows up, but what happens if I only have money to buy candles for Shabbos candles or candles for Chanukah candles, which takes precedence? Remember, the Chanukah candles takes precedence over wine for Kiddush. Why do Shabbos candles take precedence? Anybody know? Everybody. It's correct, it does take precedence. Says the Rambam, Ner beso kodem mishum shalom beso. Ner, exactly what you said, that Chanukah candles takes precedence because of shalom bias. An illuminated house is a calm house. When you're in darkness, there's conflict, there's tension. Okay, it's not comfortable. We want shalom bias. Okay? But the Rambam, you see, you all know that. But you don't know the end of the Rambam. Or you should know. Okay? Godol shalom shekol Torah nitna lasos shalom. The entire Torah is there to make peace and harmony. Shalom bias, harmony, that's the most important thing. Shenemar, and it brings a proof text. Drachea darchei noam v'chol nesivoseha shalom. That's the sort, that's the Torah. And the Rambam concludes the Chanukah with that. And when I see that, I say, so every section in Halacha could conclude with that. Everything about it. If Rambam writes that the whole Torah is for shalom, so that's about every mitzvah. Well, why is this attached specifically to Chanukah? And why is this brought in? And we're making this contrast of Kiddush, but more important is Chanukah candles and more important is Shabbos candles. I hope that we'll be able to get to that's a very subtle thing we'll hope to get to by the end. But I'm just, you don't have the source sheet because I don't always get to it. Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about the Greeks, the Greek exile. All right, then we're going to source number 5. So everybody should know, if you know Jewish history, there were 4 exiles. 4 kingdoms, 4 exiles. First one was
Babylonia,
Bavel, associated with what tragic event? The destruction of the first temple. The next exile was
Persia, Paros,
associated with first which destruction? Don't tell me about the holiday, because the holiday is the saving from the destruction. But it's called a galut. It's called an exile. What tragedy? Persia tragedy. Haman's decree to wipe out the Jewish people. I mean, had there not been a miracle, we were going to be wiped out. There was a decree, right? The decree to wipe out the Jewish people. That's Persia. Third exile was, which is what tragedy? What exile? Again, you all know, you know that Purim is the saving from Persia. And you know that Chanukah is the saving from Greece. But what was the exile of Greece? All of the decrees. All the decrees that the Greeks did. That was, they tried to uproot the Torah, tried to destroy Torah. Parenthetically, it's one of Rav Huttner's proofs that we could be in Golus in Eretz Yisrael. Because this is called a Golus, it's the third exile. And we're in Eretz Yisrael. Not only are we in Eretz Yisrael in exile, but what else is happening while we're in exile? Very unexpected. We're in exile in Eretz Yisrael with a temple. The Beis HaMikdash is running. We're in the middle of the Second Temple period. So we're in Eretz Yisrael, we have a temple, and we're called in Golus. We're called in exile. Rav Huttner points that out. So the third exile is Greece, and the fourth exile is
Edom, Rome,
and the destruction of the Second Temple. That's the one that we're still in. Chazal darshan, the second pasuk in the Torah on those 4 exiles, and that's what we have here, source number 5. Shimon ben Rish Lakish potar kari begolios. The pasuk is the haaretz haisa sohu vavohu v'choshech. Al penei tahom. 4 phrases. 4 negative phrases. Haaretz haisa sohu. Okay, tohu is desolation. Vohu is chaos. Choshech is darkness. Al penei tahom, at the abyss. Says Rosh Lakish, each of those represents one of the exiles. Alright? Choshech is, I'm sorry, a Tohu is Bavel, and he brings a proof text. Vohu is Persia, he brings a proof text. Choshech is Yavan, Greece, and he brings a proof text. And Al-Pnei Tahom is Rome, Edom, the fourth one. So which one is Greece?
Choshech.
Which means?
Darkness.
Now, that's really a very strange adjective to impute to Greece. Because Greece, basically, was the illuminator of the physical world. We know, they gave us all our science, they gave us all our math. Everything we know about the physical world basically is built on Greek wisdom, what the Greeks discovered. And Chazal say that they among all of the exiles, they're called darkness. I would have expected them, I would have called it illumination. They've illuminated our understanding of the physical world. And Chazal called that darkness. Very strange. So we're going to have to understand why that's true. Which leads us into the discussion or topic of miracles. How many people in this room would like a personal supernatural miracle to happen to them? Interesting, more women than men. Okay. I think they're just embarrassed to say they would. Why? Why would you like a personal miracle? I'm sorry? That's not a good answer. I need a better answer.
Because whatever the personal thing that one wants and is not able to achieve it through natural, so it's not going...
Would you prefer a natural or a miracle? Would you like a miracle to happen to you or just like to happen natural? You'd prefer a natural?
Yeah.
I think so. Who would prefer to have it miraculous? They need something and a supernatural miracle happens to them. You wouldn't be happy. Why would we like that to happen? Oh, come on.
It validates everything.
What does it validate?
Everything you believe in. Shine.
Listen, I think there's a God, but you know what? When a supernatural miracle happens, basically God is standing there telling you supernaturally, I'm here. That's one reason. Is there another reason? There's another reason. Another deeper reason. Besides that, that's 100% correct. What's the other reason? Think about it. The supernatural miracle happens to you. What does that say?
Hashem is doing it in an unnatural way.
For who?
Women.
Ah, so that means, that gives me a sense that God really cares about me. So it validates that there's a God. Right? The philosophical doubt that always gnaws way down deep at us. And even after we're convinced that there's a God, okay, I saw he did a supernatural miracle. He's out there. I saw supernatural miracles for you. But he probably doesn't really care about me, because what am I? Oh, he did something for me. That means he cares about me. Okay? Fine. Now let's see how the Gemara, how Chazal view miracles. Do we like miracles? So the Gemara tells a story. It's a little bit of a strange story. Trying to get beyond the logistics of the story. But the story is about Echad Shemesa Ishto. A man had a wife who died in childbirth. Now, in the old days, if a woman dies in childbirth, what's the immediate problem we confront? Sorry? What's going to happen to the baby? Why is there a problem? The baby needs to be nursed. Okay? And the mother now has died in childbirth. So what's the normal solution?
A wet nurse.
Wet nurses cost money. Right? You gotta hire a wet nurse. So this guy, his wife died in childbirth. So he has a problem, he needs to hire a wet nurse. But he has another problem. He had no money. So he couldn't afford a wet nurse. Now he has a problem, correct? Well, there was a miraculous solution, says the Gemara. Nasalones, a miraculous solution. He developed female breasts and he was able to nurse his child. Miracle? Miracle? Absolutely! Supernatural miracle! So what do we say about such a guy? So, Amar of Yosef, Bo Ray, second line in the Hebrew, I'm on the other side, you'll see the English if you can't follow. Bo Ray, Kama Godlo Adam Zed, look what a great person this is! Nasalones Kazeh, what an unbelievable miracle. This guy must be something special. God did a supernatural miracle for him. Amar lo abaye adarabba. The language of adarabba, you've heard it. What it means is exactly 180 degrees the opposite. That's what adarabba means. It doesn't mean, no, you're not right. It's not, I disagree with you. Adarabba means the exact inverse of what you're saying. Well, what did Yosef say? Kama gadol ha'ad, what a great person he is. So what does adarabba mean? Kama garua adam say. What a lowly person this must be. Sheishtamu lo sidre breishis. Because nature changed for him. Hello? That makes him lowly? How does nature changing for him indicate that he's a lowly person? I throw that open to you. Why does that make him a lowly person? God did a supernatural miracle. Changed nature for him. Guy's stuck under a car, and somebody comes along, points a finger, and the car levitates, and the guy's able to get out from under it. That sounds like the guy must be off the charts. God did such a miracle. Why is he considered a lowly person? Did God have another way to solve this problem? How?
Wealth.
He doesn't have any money. So, how could God solve the problem? He walks down the street and finds a wallet with nobody's name on it, and there's money in it. Right? Lots of ways to solve the problem. So God solved it with a supernatural miracle. Is that good news or bad news?
Bad news.
Why? I'm sorry? Louder, speak up. But say that in English. Don't just take out the emunah word. Elaborate on what you just said. Strong enough for what? What do you mean it wasn't strong enough? What does that mean?
To believe that Hashem can do anything for him, like a lot of
things. Well, I don't understand. So what would the alternative have been? Would there have been a downside if he would have found the money on the side of the street? Would there have been a downside if he would have found the money on the side of the street? It says in this Gemara, yes. For this guy, it would have been a downside. Why? Because how would he explain finding the money on the side of the street? He wouldn't have understood that that's God who sent me the money. So therefore, says Abaya, God had to send him a supernatural solution so he'll realize it's coming from God. Kama garua adam zeh. Because a higher level person, God didn't need to change nature for him to get it. So that's a lowly level. So on the one hand, wow, God was deserving of a miracle. Because the lowest person, God would have just said, I'm sorry, you're going to be, it's your problem. And I can't intervene. So he had a certain level because God intervened. But the machlokas Rav Yosef and Abaye was whether he's at the highest level because God intervened supernaturally, or that indicates a very low level because God had to intervene supernaturally because God would have missed it if it would have been a natural solution.
So this individual had righteousness.
He had some merit to deserve it.
But there'll be none. I don't understand it.
I'm not sure I would have used that word. He didn't have the level of conviction that God runs the whole world. He doesn't have the level. I think I preferred the word of emunah. He didn't have the conviction.
What kind of righteousness could he have?
He
have
a lot of
it. Maybe the problem with righteousness.
Righteousness is not a binary system. It's a very, if you still remember the analog stuff, there used to be analog things.
Right.
Right, the meter that goes all the way instead of the digital numbers. It's very analog. It goes tiny steps.
But he didn't have a sample enough to see that God runs the world.
You're using it as an, again, I don't want to impute it to any certain part of his intellect or his knowledge or whatever. Again, maybe we'll even talk about that later, exactly what part it is. But let's just say he wasn't at the level to have recognized that a natural event was coming from God. He wasn't at that level of recognition, but he apparently deserved some kind of intervention because God intervened, as opposed to just saying it's your problem. Okay? So what we get from here is the idea that we don't like miracles so much. Miracles is not such a thing that we should want. See, because now I'll go back to what the ladies said and what the men were probably thinking but were embarrassed to say because it makes them vulnerable to their emotions, is that when God does a miracle for me, it helps me believe. But that means I needed that help. A person shouldn't need a miracle to believe in God. And a person shouldn't need a personal miracle to have that sense of importance that God cares about me. That has to come without the miracles. It should come from inside of you as opposed to outside of there. And if you like miracles, it's an indication that, like Abaya said, we're on a lower level. Right? Because as if the supernatural miracle is going to change something about my attitude, either towards God or to my self-awareness and my self-esteem. That means that I've got a problem in my awareness of God and my self-esteem that can be fixed by a supernatural miracle. We shouldn't need that. Okay?
Rabbi, if somebody has a serious illness and you pray for deliverance for that person.
Beyond the scope of this.
It's a miracle.
Beyond the scope of this class.
Wait a second now. It's not beyond. It's a miracle is a miracle. That's a miracle. A person has...
Do people get better if I don't pray for them?
But the
you're a doctor. Do people get better if people are, if they're not prayed for?
We don't know. We don't know who prays and who doesn't. People pray when they get sick.
Everybody?
I think so. I'm not sure.
I'm also not sure. I believe that there's no question that people have become very wealthy without praying, and they get shiduchim without praying, and they have kids without praying. Stuff happens without davening. It's a question. It's beyond. It's not today's shiur. Next year, I'll come back and give you a shiur on prayer and what the efficacy of prayer is. You're taking me a little off topic. It's not defined as a miracle. A miracle is defined as something supernatural. When you give somebody antibiotics and the infection goes away, we call it miraculous on one level, but it would be a distortion to call that a miracle in the context of how we understand miracles. You're going to see in a minute from the Ramban a deeper understanding. But we have to keep our terms straight. Miracle means supernatural. Yes, when I let this watch go, which I won't do because it's going to fall down, it could just as easily have flown up. It could have levitated just like it fell. But if it falls, I say that was expected and that's natural. And if it levitates, that's a miracle. Even though there's no logical reason why the laws of nature say it goes down instead of up. Okay, so we have to define our terms. You're pulling me a little off topic. Hold off. At the end, I'll take questions. If necessary. Okay? So now, let's see the Ramban. Maybe this will help. What we're going to see now in the Ramban will help. Okay? So since the Ramban, source number 7. Because this is now we're going to get into the issue of miracles and how we relate to those miracles. So the Ramban, I'm going to let you read it yourself, either in the Hebrew or the English. I may just pick out a few phrases, but I'll give you a summary of what the Ramban is saying in source number 7. The Ramban describes 3 kinds of heresy. Please have a read yourself. Probably the easiest is the English, but I want you to get through it quickly while I'm talking. Okay? So the Ramban has 3 kinds of heresy. One heresy is that the world has no creator. The world is eternal. A Richard Dawkins kind of a heresy. A Stephen Hawking attempted heresy because he still has trouble really verifying it in the laws of physics. Dawkins seems to have no trouble because he's a biologist and they don't really get it. But the physicists realize they have a problem, but they try to say the world is eternal. It was always there. Okay? That's one kind of heresy. The next kind of heresy is at least they acknowledge and recognize that the world was created by some creator, and then the creator went on vacation. That's it. He created the world, and now he left it alone. That's also another level of heresy. And the third level of heresy is he knows what's happening, but he couldn't care less. Something along the lines of, anybody have a fish aquarium? Anybody have a fishbowl of fish aquarium? Nobody has a fish aquarium. I think this is the first audience I'm giving this year to. And nobody in the audience has an aquarium. But you know what a fish aquarium is? Okay, so you have fish swimming around in the aquarium, right? If you would stand there and concentrate, could you know where each fish is at any moment? You sit there and you're very focused on watching those fish. You could follow where each fish is at every moment, correct? Do you really care? Do you really care? So we can know and not care. That's also heresy. God knows everything that's happening, but we could say that he doesn't care. Okay, that's heresy. So says the Ramban, those 3 heresies were dispelled in the Exodus from Egypt. When God changed nature, what does that show? It shows the laws of nature were created, and they are controlled. And when he changes the nature at exactly the right moment, so it shows that he knows what's happening. He's paying attention. And when he does it for the Jewish people to save them from destruction, like at Kriyat Yamsuf, it shows that he cares. In other words, he intervened to save the good guys and kill the bad guys. So that shows that he knows, that he controls, he knows, and he cares. So said the Ramban, the whole Exodus story dispels and explodes the myth of all 3 of those heresies. Okay, that is source number 7. And then the Ramban says, that's why now when you read the Psukim, you see that when God talks about all the miracles he's going to do, he says it's Laman Da'at Ki Ani Hashem Bekerav Haaretz, I am God. Be care of Haaretz, that I'm paying attention to what's going on. Okay, and that's the whole discussion of the Exodus. And then the Ramban in source number 9 says as follows. He solves the next problem. Of course, so you all know the Exodus story, right? And they say it happened. So anybody who witnessed it believes that there's a God, right? Because you saw it. You saw supernatural. You saw intervention, etc. There's just one problem. That happened for them. What did you do for me lately, God? I mean, okay, you did it for them. How am I supposed to know? Is that a good question? It's a great question. So what would you like? Do it for me too. You do it for me. I'm also, okay, I got, if I would have been there, I would certainly believe. But I wasn't there, so what are you going to do? Says the Ramban. I'll read it in, all right? Follow me in English. I like to read it in the Hebrew, if that's okay. I think most of the audience here can more or less follow the Hebrew, but you follow me in English in number 9. Ubavur ki HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo yaseh otu mofet b'chol dor leinei kol rasha o kofir. If we want to translate into our terms, God doesn't show his stuff to every doubting Thomas. Well, every generation, somebody's going to come along and say, well, I didn't see it, show me God. But sorry, it doesn't work like that. So, but what does he do? Yitzave otanu shenaseh tamid zikaron v'ot l'asheroi. But he legislated many mitzvot, where the whole purpose of the mitzvah is to validate and to concretize that this really happened, and then he commanded us to transmit this generation to generation. So therefore we have the Pesach Seder, where every year we recount what happened, and if it didn't happen, you've got to figure out where in Jewish history did some charismatic huckster convince everybody to do it, and that it happened. Okay, and we have tefillin, which is written in there, and we have mezuzah, and we have all of these mitzvos that are there generation after generation to transmit to us that it really happened. And that's why, says the Ramban, we place such a significant importance on these mitzvos. It's the only, right, Korban Pesach is the only positive commandment for which if you don't do it, you have karet, and eating chametz on Pesach is karet, very serious, because this is the foundation of our religion. Okay, and that's what the Ramban says at the end of source number 9. Okay, in source number 9 is that this is why it's so important. Now we come to the most important piece, source number 10. So, guess what? Fine, okay, so we saw the Exodus, we saw this intervention. You know what? We transmitted it generation after generation. Now I know God does supernatural stuff. Okay, does that have any ramifications on my day-to-day life? The fact that now I know God created the world, controls the world, can change nature, and cares what's going on. Says the Ramban, source number 10. The very famous line in the Ramban. Source number 10, I'm on the top of the page. Umin ha-nisim ha-gedolim ha-mefursamim adam odeh b'nisim ha-nistarim. Once you acknowledge that there are open miracles, that God controls the world, that God cares about what happens, so now you can realize that there is natural intervention, what the Ramban calls nes nistar, the fact that there are hidden miracles. Hidden miracles in the Ramban's language means that God intervenes, but there's two ways he can intervene. He can intervene through a supernatural way. He can intervene with that guy stuck under the car, that the car levitates and the guy just crawls out. Or he can intervene where it just so happens that a fire truck with a crane exactly at that moment is driving by and they're able in time to lift up the car and get him out. So when we know that God intervenes in a supernatural way, we now can believe and have conviction that he intervenes all the time in our lives. And the Ramban says that's why we have this idea that when you do mitzvot in Eretz Yisrael, it rains, and when you behave in an abominable way, the land kicks you out with war, right, and exile. Even though that's natural, it rains, and it doesn't rain, and there's war. So it could be misinterpreted as natural events. It's part of history, it's part of nature. From the supernatural miracles, we realize that God is intervening all the time. Okay? All right, that's source number 10. Maybe before we see source number 11, so let's step back now and try to understand a little bit what this is all about. Ah, okay, I'm sorry. I skipped one important line, and now is the time to go back to it. Go back to 5 for a minute. All right, we talked in source number 5 about how the Greek exile is called Choshech. But we didn't explain why. The Medrash continues. The Medrash continues. Look at the last, the second to the last line in the Hebrew. In the middle of the line, Choshech Zeg Galut Yavan. In the English, it's in the middle of the second line after the three dots. Choshech. All right, source number five. Choshech Zeg Galut Yavan. Shehichshicha Einehem Shel Yisrael B'Gezeroteha. They darkened the eyes of the Jewish people through decrees. What were those decrees? Shaita Omerik Lem Kitvu Al Keren Hashor, right on the horn of an ox, Ein Lachem Chelek Be'Elokei Yisrael. You have no portion in the God of Israel. So I'm not going to go into why it was on the horn of a bull, that's beyond today, but I want to focus on the decree. Ein Lachem Chelek Be'Elokei Yisrael, you have no portion in the God of Israel. Is that an atheistic statement? Could Richard Dawkins have ever made such a statement? We want you to declare that you have no portion in the God of Israel. Could Richard Dawkins make that statement? Why not?
Because it doesn't imply that there's no God, it just says there's no God of Israel.
It presupposes the existence of
that. That's the first step. It presupposes that there is a God, except it says that.
You have no portion.
What does that mean, no portion? No connection. You have no connection with the God of Israel. There's a God, but you have no connection. Here is the crunch. This is the thesis. This is the point of conflict between Greek Hellenistic culture and Judaism. Is there a relationship between man and God or not? Now, we have a natural world. We have a world of science. We have a world of nature. That's there. Natural law. What governs natural law? Nature. And does gravity work 98% of the time or 100% of the time? Gravity, laws of nature are laws of nature. They're immutable. So when I look at laws of nature, what could I easily see? Well, I'll tell you what I could not see. I don't see God. I see laws of physicality where, and this is Greek ideology, man, what exists is what we see. What exists is what we can measure. If it's not measurable, if it's not perceivable with our five senses, it doesn't exist. Basically what Richard Dawkins says over and over again. Okay, he says, the question of whether there is a God or not, he calls it a scientific question. I don't know if you read any of his stuff. It's a scientific question. If it's a scientific question, how do we answer the question? How do you answer a scientific question?
Measure.
Experimentation.
With scientific method. Physical. Scientific method is null hypothesis and observable data and statistics. Okay, so that's okay. If it's a scientific question, God loses. No way God can win if it's a scientific question. Why? Because God isn't scientific. God is transcendent. So they weren't denying the Greeks that there's God, but he's saying God is up there and there is a spiritual world. But it has absolutely nothing to do with this world. This is a physical world. It's a mechanistic world. And if it's a mechanistic physical world, so then man's morality, or morality is spiritual. So that has no input. That has no connection. There's no connection between what happens here and what goes on up there. That's Greek ideology. So therefore, miracles? Miracles don't happen. Is there any difference scientifically between a flask of oil that's tameh and a flask of oil that's tahor? Is there any scientific measurable difference between a flask that's tameh and a flask that's tahor? So in what dimension does that difference exist? Where do we see that?
Can't see it.
So what we really said is that there is a dimension of reality that's hidden. There's an inner dimension of reality that exists that you can't measure. At least if you don't have the right tools. But is it there? Absolutely there. So when the Greeks come along and they say that the only reality is materialistic, physical, mechanistic. So have they illuminated reality or have they distorted reality?
Darkened.
They have darkened my picture of reality. Because if all I see is a scientific reality, then I'm walking around in darkness. Because I'm not seeing the reality. I'm seeing only the surface of the reality. Because the physical is always the surface. The spiritual The hidden is on the inner dimension. It's below the surface. Where does free will reside? Well, in a mechanistic world, anybody who studied serious behavioral psychology understands that in the world of behavioral psychology, where does free will reside? Where does free will reside in serious, dogmatic behavioral psychology? Where does free will reside? Where's my psychology graduate students? I'm sorry, say that again louder. It doesn't exist. Behavioral psychology means that everything about me is a product of environment and inputs. No free will. It's all mechanistic. So they deny free will because you can't measure it. But free will resides where? In the inner dimension, in the hidden dimension. Well, this is what the Greeks exactly came to deny. Okay? And there's where chelik melelik. See, if you believe in free will, and you believe in what the Ramban says about how God intervenes, so then my moral behavior, whether I steal or cheat or keep Shabbos or keep kosher, that has spiritual ramifications, which can influence the spiritual world. And if there's chelek be'elokei Yisrael, then that comes back down and has impact and consequences in the physical world. But if there's no connection, it has no connection. So what difference does it make whether you keep Shabbos or not, whether you eat kosher or not? It doesn't matter, because it doesn't have any, because there's no spiritual connections. So here's the conflict. But it all resides in the inner dimension, and that's where we're coming into conflict. Let me read you, there's a Rambam that I did not include, but it's a fascinating Rambam. I want you to listen carefully and pick out the theme. The Rambam basically describes what the Greeks do. And I want you to pick up the theme of the Rambam. What's the point? If you have to summarize, what were the Greeks doing to us? The Rambam, in introducing Chanukah, says, sorry, I left it out of the source sheet. It was actually left out by accident. I'll have to pull it up on another source sheet. The Rambam, in the introduction to Chanukah, he does a very strange thing. When he opens the laws of Chanukah, he first gives us a history lesson, which is itself very strange. B'bayit Sheni Malchu Yavan, when the Greeks ruled, Gazru Gezerot Al Yisrael, they made decrees against the Jewish people. Decrees against us. U'bitlu datam. They annulled our religion. They didn't let us study Torah. Uva mitzvot, they didn't let us be involved in mitzvot. Upashtu yadam, and they extended their hands. Bimamonam, against our money. Ubibnoteim, against our daughters. Vinichnasu lehechel, they went into the sanctuary. Vipirtsu bapratzot, they breached many breaches. Vitibu ataharot, they defiled the pure things. Vitzar lehem Yisrael, they oppressed the Jewish people. And they oppressed us much until God had mercy. So what was the theme? Why is Rambam introducing us with a history lesson? What's the theme of this history lesson? What happened? What did the Greeks do? In concise one line, what did the Greeks do to us?
Took advantage.
You didn't hear that. What did the Greeks do to us?
Religious persecution.
Home run. Bingo. A religious persecution. Let's read the words. They gazru gzeirot, biklu datam, lo inichu lasok b'torah u'mitzvos, timu ha'echa, timu ha'ta'arot. It's all religious persecution. But now listen to one phrase that God dropped in there. It doesn't belong there, if it's religious persecution. And it's definitely religious persecution. U'pashtu yadam, they extended their hands, bibnotehem, against our daughters. That's religious persecution. But I skipped the word. They extended their hands to our money and to our daughters. Extending our hands against our money. That's religious persecution, or that's... What did you say in the back? Taking advantage. They're hoodlums. They're hoodlums. They're gay. Right? They're mafiosis. Well, what does that have to do with religious persecution? It's very strange that that gets dropped in. So again, there are other sources to expand on this idea, but the idea is that in Judaism, every physical act, every physical resource has spiritual potential. That's our thesis. Physical resources have spiritual potential. Last week's parsha, why Yaakov Avinu went back for Pachim Ketanim, for those little vessels. Because to Yaakov Avinu, the littlest, the smallest thing is a spiritual resource. Well, where does that spiritual resource reside? Well, if you look at the surface, physical things are physical. And money is money. And money is what kind of a car can I buy, and what kind of a vacation can I take, and how big of a house can I buy. That's money. That's on the physical level. That's on the external level. But there's spiritual potential in the money, because I can take that money and elevate it and sanctify it and use it for spiritual activities, and then all of a sudden the money became something else. That is not a Greek perception. But it's a Jewish perception. And therefore, extending their hands against our money was also like walking in and touching the oil. Huh. Nothing changed physically. Ah, but they're spiritual. They were denying the content of the spirituality. Okay. So now, where does the spiritual content reside? Surface? No. It resides here, but it's an inner dimension. It's in this world, but it's an inner, hidden dimension of reality in this world. Who do you love best? We love you all the same. How's that possible? How's it possible to love us all the same? Parents who said it. I know the kids never believed it, but the parents who said it. Did you believe it? How? How's it possible? How's it possible to love all your children the same? I'm not going to answer that. You guys better. I need you to think about that.
Each kid has a different, like, unique thing about the kid, right?
Everyone's different. Every child is different. So I can love every child equally, because what I'm loving about each child is what's unique. Now let's talk about uniqueness and individuality for a minute. In a physical, materialistic environment, what's the difference between people? What car they drive, what hair do they wear, their styles, how much money they make. It's all externals, because that's all there is the externals. But really, it's all the same. The fact that you put a tattoo on your leg, or a big tattoo on your back, or the fact that you drive a $200,000 car instead of a $50,000 car, that's not really making you really different. We're all the same with an illusion of difference. The real difference is in the personality. The real difference is in the neshama. The real difference is in the hidden dimensions. The real difference is in the quality of your free will. That's all hidden away. Hanukkah was about making that declaration that there is a hidden dimension beyond the physicality, beyond what we observe on the surface. That when they say Ein lachem chelek b'Elokei Yisrael, we say we are connected. Okay? The mechanistic laws of nature are darkness because they hide the true reality. So when we talk about real differences between people, it's in the hidden dimension. Hanukkah was there to say that we had a miracle that was there to demonstrate that we're not subject to the laws of nature. That the laws of nature are changeable based on morality. That if we behave in a certain way, God intervenes. That there's a connection. Okay? What word am I looking for?
Pipeline.
Yeah, there's a pipeline there. There's an interface between the physical world and the spiritual world that has impact and influence based on my moral choices. So therefore, when the Jews rededicated and they fought for their Jewish values, God responded with a miracle that might not have even been necessary. But he needed to show, because we were losing touch with that, he needed to show exactly what you all needed for that miracle. We needed to revalidate the fact that God's connected, that God cares, that God intervenes. So we needed a miracle. But that miracle now is there to validate that there's a reality of an inner hidden dimension, and that in that dimension reflects individuality. So specifically in this mitzvah, in the only mitzvah where we program levels of observance, it's a recognition that people are different. It's a recognition that people are individuals. And it's not a one-size-fits-all. And it's a very important lesson today, okay, where we have a Judaism that seems to be more and more conformist. We're not acknowledging the fact that the neshamas are different and we each relate to God differently. But that's what Chanukah represents. Chanukah says you light that little wick and you extract from that oil or that wax something that you never thought was there. That energy and that oil and that illumination, that's hidden away. And we extract it and it illuminates. So what we're doing is we're illuminating from the hidden dimensions. That's where the individual comes in. That's why we have levels of individual. It's a unique thing that there's levels. That today everybody does Mahadrim and Mahadrim. Seder, okay? But the idea, Chazal recognized that there have to be levels of Chanukah observance because that's what the holiday stands for. Let's just see the last Rambam because we want to come back to miracles. And maybe I'll introduce it with a Shlomo Carlebach story. A woman comes up to her, Shlomo, says, Rabbi, you know, I don't believe in God. Any people with experience in the theory of world here? You know how to respond to that, right? You have your proofs, and you have your theories, right? Everybody knows how to respond to that, right? That's not what Shlomo said. Shlomo says to her, ma'am, if you want to live in a world without a God, go ahead. To think about the profundity of that statement. Let's see source number 11 and then we'll tie it together. So the Rambam says, to dispel conventional wisdom, that why did the Jewish people believe that Moshe Rabbeinu was the prophet and they accorded him all the authority and they followed him into the desert and they believed him and they accepted the Torah from him? The default, the conventional wisdom is he did miracles. Look at all those miracles he did. So if he knows miracles, the Torah must be true. Says the Rambam, I'll do it in the English. Jewish people did not believe in Moshe Rabbeinu because of the miracles he performed. Anyone whose belief is based on miracles has a gnawing doubt in his heart, since it's possible that the miracles were done through some kind of magic or sorcery. A person who is absolutely wedded to a mechanistic scientific system, you will show Richard Dawkins supernatural miracles and his reaction will be, okay, let's figure out how you did that. So then why did Moshe do miracles? So then, okay, so it's not going to work to really make you believe. Way down deep you're going to wonder, maybe there's some trick going on here. So why did he do the miracles? Says the Rambam, a huge chiddush. Not everybody agrees with this. All the miracles, according to the Rambam, on source number 11, all the miracles were done out of necessity, not to validate prophecy. It was necessary to drown the Egyptians, he split the sea, they had no food, he brought down the mon, etc., etc. Functional miracles. Well, in that case, so why did we believe in Moshe? So on what did we base our belief in Moshe? On our observations at Sinai, where our own eyes witnessed, and our own ears heard, fire sounds, torches, Moshe approaching the mist, and the voice of the Almighty speaking to him, and we heard Moshe, Moshe. We experienced God communicating with Moshe. That's what we needed. That's why we now have an irreversible Torah from Moshe. The Ramban goes on to explain that if the only reason we accepted Moshe's Torah was miracles, then we could have a prophet coming along later and do bigger miracles and say, okay, now it's time to change the Torah. Because I just did miracles, so I'm proving that I'm a prophet. Says the Rambam, no, miracles, at the end of the day, supernatural miracles leave a doubt. So then where do you have to believe in God? Well, they saw it at Sinai. And us? If miracles can always leave a gnawing doubt, okay, and I wasn't at Sinai. So where does my belief come from? There's the message of Rosh Shlomo. That's not what Rosh Shlomo said. That's also not what Rosh Shlomo said. You want to live in a world without God? Go ahead. I'm sorry, somebody said something very important. It's your free choice. You have to go into yourself. And this is where free choice is there. And you have to decide. And that's buried deep into the person. and the person has to work deeply to identify. One of our problems, of course, is that when we want to know who we are and what we really want, we don't know. Think about it. I'll ask you, what do you want? What would you really like to have? And I'll say, and why? What do you, somebody, you want a lot of money? You want a fancy car? You want a shidduch? You want the kids? You want a big house? I don't know. You know, you want the Phillies to win the World Series one day. What do you want and why? Why do you want money? Because. And when you think carefully about what we want, most of what we want is what other people told us we want. Or because it's not really what we want, but we really want something else. We don't even know what we want. You've got to go deep, deep into yourself to see what you really want. Who am I? Not who are other people telling me I am. That's hidden away very deep. And all God can do is He can let you know that He's here and that He cares and that He has a relationship with you, and you've got to feel that. You've got to identify it, you've got to feel it, and then you've got to live it. That's really what the miracle of Hanukkah was coming to do, was coming to negate this idea that the world just runs and that we have to just look at things superficially. We need to look at the hidden dimensions of reality. Okay? And the hidden dimensions is where our individuality resides. The hidden dimensions is where our free choice resides. And our the individual hidden dimension is where our relationship with God lies. And that's a very deep message of Hanukkah. I will take questions now if there are any.
Just wanted, before the question, I just want to thank Rabbi Gerlinski. It's always a special treat, and I'm sure all our collectively our Hanukkah will be greatly enhanced. Thank you, Rabbi Gerlinski, for taking the time.
Yes.
Could you go up one more time? So, even on this, the purpose of the miracles, and on Sinai, even on what you said.